Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night, wherever you are in the world, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin speaking to you with Richard Martin's wake-up call with you for the hour. I'm sure all of you have been made aware of the fact that the chief executive officers of the world's largest bank and the world's largest brokerage firms, two independent companies, publicly traded companies, CEOs have been dismissed or have resigned in disgrace for shenanigans of one sort or another, which we've talked about. You've all seen the soaring commodity prices, soaring gold prices, the collapse of the dollar. So the crisis in general is growing by leaps and bounds. It's still being described as a subprime meltdown, with the implication that it's all contained within a very small section of the credit arena. But of course, that's absolutely ludicrous, because it is quite clear now that the contagion has seriously spread to out of the subprime arena to near prime and even prime mortgages. And in addition, as I mentioned last week, it is spreading to subprime and near-prime credit cards and even auto loans, where it's clear that delinquencies are rising and will sharply rise further in the year ahead. It is spreading to every corner of the securitized financial system that is either now frozen or on the way to freezing. CDO issuance is near dead. The leveraged buyout market and the related leveraged loans market is piling deals that have been postponed, restructured, or cancelled. The liquidity squeeze in the interbank market, especially at the 1 month to 3 months maturities, is continuing. The losses at banks and investment banks will experience in the next few quarters will erode their capital ratio. The asset-backed commercial paper and related securitized investment vehicle sectors are near dead and unraveling. And since the new super conduit that I mentioned, it looks like it's going to flop now because nobody is really interested in subscribing to it. The only options available to these securitized firm creators are bringing those securitized investment vehicle assets on balance sheet, because of course they're off balance sheet now, as you know, with of course the concomitant significant capital and liquidity effects. Or of course they could sell them at a large loss. There are similar problems now with crunches emerging in the CLO, CMO, and CMBS markets. Junk bond spreads are widening. Corporate default rates will soon start to rise. Every corner of the securitization world is now under severe stress, including so-called highly rated and, quote, safe, that's to say, AAA and AA securities. Since I spoke to you last, two credit unions have bitten the dust. One is Cal State 9 Credit Union, all through, of course, the defaulting on mortgages. It's the same old problem. You're insured, of course, as I've mentioned before, up to the 100,000 per person FDIC limit. The other credit union is the Green Tree Federal Credit Union. Now we're beginning to see a slump in the commercial real estate market, as you will doubtless see if you have any kind of exposure there. You know, the ratings company Fitch is now lowering AAA credit ratings on several bond insurers, including MBIA, AmBank, and CIFG, all household names in this country. Imagine that. These are bond insurance companies rated AAA themselves, which themselves are now being downgraded. I mean, it's truly a shameful scandal that these people who were clearly bought off by the companies that they were supposed to be rating independently have now obviously seen defaults and downgrades to their own rated paper to the extent and to the point at which they themselves, the ratings companies, are being downgraded. You know, and I quote someone called Thomas Abrozzo, an analyst with Fitch in New York. He said, and I quote, "What we thought was a hypothetical based on analysis done in the summer has become the base case." In other words, it's just an admission that this whole thing is unraveling by leaps and bounds. Okay, again, my name is Richard Martin. The program you are listening to is called Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and it comes to you by courtesy of the Progressive Radio Network every Tuesday and Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. If you would like to talk to me directly, you may do so by picking up the phone and dialing 305-357-5575. I will repeat that. That's the number to call me in private directly with any questions, problems, or other concerns you may have. The number, again, is 305-357-5575. All right. Now, if you would like to send me an email, you may do so, as always, by writing to, and I give you the address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. As always, please, corporation is one word. You write the word out in full. The G and the S stand for Global Strategic. The company where I work in Miami is called Global Strategic Investments. And please remember to write all in lower case. I will give you the address once more. It is rmartin@gscorporation.com. And then, of course, the toll-free number for you to call right now or at any time in the next 50 minutes with your questions and concerns. We all want to hear from you. I am always delighted to get your calls over the air. And you may do this by dialing toll-free 888-873-4643. I repeat that. 888-873-4643. Okay. We have an email from Frank Devlin, who was kind enough to send me an email also, I believe, on Friday. He has another question, and I will read it out. And he writes, "Richard, it seems that credit default swaps have been added to George Carlin's list of bad words one hardly, if ever, hears the words uttered by the mainstream financial media. With the current write-downs and write-offs in CDOs, have there been any problems with the credit default swaps connected to them, or are the losses being lumped together and being reported as one number? Or are the credit default swaps being held in some sort of off-balance sheet vehicle to disguise and prolong the day of reckoning? The financial industry seems to have a genius for prolonging bad news. Now, if they could only contain the smell." Nice, Frank. Thank you for that one. "Keep up the excellent and invaluable work, Frank." All right, Frank. Well, your vivid language is entitled to a vivid response, and I shall give you one. But just before I do that, I'd like to remember something that I meant to do while giving out information to people with pens and paper. I would like to give you a website where you can get an update, or rather, like a sort of primer on the derivatives market. The derivatives market is, of course, one where which we've discussed, which derives itself from the underlying securities, which in the cases that we've been discussing are mortgages. So if there's anybody, and this applies particularly to people who have come to listen to me since fairly recently, because a few months ago I spent quite a long time actually describing what derivatives are and giving some examples, and I devoted quite a lot of airtime to that. So I don't really want to go through it again, but it is extremely important that you know what this is all about. Actually, it's very important because the crisis, the real banking crisis, will be directly a function of this very phenomenon. And so I would urge you all to get a quick refresher course on this. It's not long, but it really, I think, it's worth your while to get to the nitty-gritty of this and make sure that you really understand it, because I wouldn't say it's fascinating, although it is. If the world's major banks are really going to go under, or some of them are going to go under because of this, it probably would be a nice idea if you knew the horrors of what exactly have been perpetrated over the last few years to cause this frightful situation in which we find ourselves today. So, ladies and gentlemen, I wish you please to grab your pencils or your pens and your paper, and I am going to dictate the website. When I gave the website to Ron Paul, who, by the way, raised $3 million yesterday, I am absolutely stunned. This is the largest one-day contribution of money to any political campaign in the history of the United States of America. It happened yesterday, Guy Fawkes Day, the 5th of November, and this was done without any input from Ron Paul himself. It was all grassroots efforts that were internet-based and may well, in my opinion, revolutionize the whole concept of what presidential campaigns are all about in this country, because once you've got the people involved on the internet, the importance of the big campaign sponsors diminishes proportionately. So instead of having a few people contributing a lot of money, you have many people contributing a little money, which could, in fact, outweigh the balance. So this is very fascinating, something I definitely suggest that you follow. Anyway, back to the derivatives website. Here we go, ladies and gentlemen, get ready. I'm going to read it to you right now. www.economist.com/business/display story, or one word, .cfm, that's Charlie, Freddie, Mary, CFM, ? Story, _, ID, equals, 90333448, and then hit enter. All right, I'm going to read it to you once again, so don't despair if you've missed anything out there. Actually, I'll probably read it out a couple of times. Okay. All right, here we go. www.economist.com/ business/displaystory.cfm. That's Charlie, Freddie, Mary. CFM *story_ID =9033348. All right. So the equals, of course, is an equal sign. You don't write the word equals. It's an equal sign. Okay. So I'm going to read this once more, ladies and gentlemen, just for you to check it. I spend the time doing this because I think it's important for you to get to read this. So I'd be grateful if you did so. All right. Here we go once more. www.economist.com/business/display story.cfm/Charlie, Freddie, Mary. CFM*story_ID =9033348. Okay. So, let's have a look at this situation and see what we have here. Okay. These credit default swaps on Merrill Lynch, for example, are now trading as if the company was rated below investment grade. And that's according to data from the credit strategy group of Moody's Investor Service. Moody's lowered its rating on Merrill Lynch one level on October 24th to A1, which is in fact six levels above the investment grade threshold. Citigroup, on the other hand, is trading as if it were rated BAA3, which is the lowest investment grade rating, ladies and gentlemen. It is eight levels below its actual senior unsecured debt rating by Moody's, and that comes from the data itself. Credit default swaps tied to MBIA, the world's biggest bond insurer, rose 60 basis points to 480 basis points, the widest in at least 3 years, and that's according to CMA Data Vision in New York. AmBac Financial Group, the second biggest bond issue insurer, climbed 63 basis points to 689 basis points, and that also is from CMA. Well, you know, if Citigroup, the world's largest bank, the most prestigious bank, apart from maybe JP Morgan, trading at the lowest investment grade rating, ladies and gentlemen, this is, if ever since I started these programs on Progressive Radio Network, if ever the wake-up call ever meant anything, it means wake up here to the plight of Citigroup. It is very, very serious. You know, clearly what must be going on behind the scenes is that claims are being presented fast and furious to collect on the various real defaults and trickery going on in the Ponzi system that we've talked so much about. Remember, even a deferral of a payment, you know, which has been agreed to between the creditor and the debtor, is technically a debt restructuring and will trigger demands for claims repayments from credit insurers. The commercial paper market seems just one likely suspect. Banks worldwide have $891 billion at risk in asset-backed commercial paper facilities because of credit agreements that ensure investors are paid back when the short-term debt matures, and that comes from Fitch Ratings. According to the Bank of International Settlements, the OTC market, that's the over-the-counter market, for credit default swaps, jumped from $4.7 trillion at the end of 2004 to $22.6 trillion at the end of 2006. From the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, we know that the total notional volume of credit derivatives jumped about 30% this past year to $45.5 $5 trillion. And from the Comptroller of the Currency, we find that total U.S. commercial bank credit derivative positions ballooned from $492 billion to beginning 2003 to $11.8 trillion as of this past June. Well, it goes without saying that this explosion of credit insurance occurred concurrently with the expansion of the riskiest mortgage lending imaginable. It's got counterparty fiasco written all over it. The inability to hedge rising default risk has become and will remain a major systemic issue. It is now clear that the delusional hope that the severe credit and liquidity crunch that hit the U.S. and global financial markets would ease has been shattered by the events of the past few weeks. The amount of losses that financial institutions have all recognized, which is $20 billion, is just the very tip of the iceberg of much larger losses that will end up in the hundreds of billions of dollars. At stake, in subprime alone, is about $1 trillion of subprime-related RMBS and hundreds of billions of mortgage-related CDOs. The reality is that most financial institutions, i.e. banks, commercial banks, pension funds, hedge funds, have barely started to recognize the lower fair value of their impaired securities. You know, many Wall Street firms are still playing the game of putting too many assets in the level three bucket of mark-to-model models that don't make much sense. And, you know, the level three are securities where the lack of market prices allows them to use dubious valuation models, so-called, and so-called unobservable inputs to value such assets. So just remember, level three assets are those that you can't value, basically. A report by the Financial Times yesterday, a research report by the Bank of England, shows that small minor changes of assumptions in these models can lead to changes in the value of so-called safe assets of 35%. So even AAA or AA assets may be worth much less than par, as the ABX is telling us. But financial institutions are not using the prices derived from the ABX indices to value most of their subprime assets. You know, the prices for the AAA and AA tranches that until recently were hovering near par or 100 are now down to 79 and 50 respectively. I mean, that's huge. Do you have own a AAA, ladies and gentlemen, do you want to own a AAA asset which you bought for 100 and which is now trading at 79? I mean, this is all nonsense. You know, hundreds of billions of subprime RMBSs and senior tranches of CDOs are still being evaluated as if they're worth 100 cents on the dollar. What the ABX is telling you is that they're worth much less. Thus, the losses from subprime alone are an order of magnitude larger than recognized by most firms. But most firms are not using such market prices or their proxies to value their liquid assets. Indeed, according to a Market Watch article from September based on Bernstein research, many Wall Street firms put an excessive amount of securities in the level three bucket, one I just mentioned, that uses unreliable models for valuation. And to give you some idea, the share securities in the level three is 15% for Goldman Sachs, 13% for Morgan Stanley, 8% for Lehman Brothers, and 7% for Bear Stearns, and only 2% for Merrill Lynch. No wonder that Merrill has been one of the few firms to report massive losses. It is at least one of the few firms that has come out clean on this valuation game and put only 2% of its assets in the voodoo valuation model bucket. Compare that with the 15% put in by Goldman and the 13% by Morgan Stanley. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not sure I know where you get this information other than from me. I don't know who wants to come out and admit this kind of stuff. It's just too grim to contemplate. You know? All right. So we have a question, an email question from Brian Troisi, who writes, and I just opened it up, so I have no idea what he's going to say. Given the current events, do you think that there is a likelihood that Citigroup is in danger of bankruptcy? Keep up your invaluable contributions to us all. Thank you, Brian. Well, thank you, Brian. Answer, yes. I certainly do. I think it is quite clear to my mind that Citigroup will be reconstituted as another kind of financial entity, even if it doesn't go bankrupt. But I think there is a high degree of likelihood that it will go bankrupt. Most of these big banks actually now have liabilities which exceed their capitalization. They are technically bankrupt already. I mean, it's just the confidence and the Fed, which is basically making short-term loans, that are keeping these things afloat. I mean, this happened in Japan in the 90s. This is not the first time that this happened. But the difference between Japan and the United States is that Japan, the Japanese are savers. They always were. I mean, you know, Tokyo is so small, there's nothing to spend any money on anyway. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Japanese have never been big spenders like the Americans. So they had something to fall back on in the late 90s when things really went badly for them. Americans are now totally exposed. They have nothing to go for. So, yes, it's a very serious problem, Brian. And thank you for the question. Let's have a look to see. We have another we have a question here, from Karen, who says, "Hello, Richard. You mentioned that two credit unions recently went under. Do you recommend that we keep our money in banks rather than credit unions? Thank you for your informative show, Karen." Well, Karen, like I've said many times on this show, you ought to spread your money around so that you have a maximum of $100,000 in any of these FDIC-insured institutions, because then you're covered. And really doesn't matter much which institution it is, particularly. But I think credit unions are as good as banks in that respect. Just be sure that, if you do have, you're lucky enough to have, $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 spare cash, make sure that it's properly diversified among the different institutions. Okay, and then we have another email from Don Riggs, who says, and I read the part of his email pertaining to his question. He says, "My question for your show is, can and should the Feds raise interest rates to kill inflation that is seeping through the economy and to attract money from overseas a la Paul Volcker in 1980, stamping out inflation for a time? Or would that just destroy our internal economy?" Don Riggs. Well, Don, and everybody else, I like to be short, sweet, and sharp in these matters, and the answer is yes to all your questions. The reality is that the Fed, by reducing the rates of interest, basically are subjecting this country to an increased specter of rising prices, which doesn't necessarily equate to inflation, but I kind of discussed that more. I think I maybe should devote a little more time to this concept of inflation as things are getting rather out of hand price-wise. Not necessarily inflation, ladies and gentlemen. Little hard to understand that, but never mind, it's not going to make much difference to your lives. But the reality is that, of course, you know, when the price of the dollar goes down or the interest rates go down, then the process is sort of self-perpetuating, and the dollar goes even further down. Oil gets more and more expensive, as do other commodities. It's a form of price rise phenomenon which is exported abroad outside the United States. And it doesn't really help the balance of payments like people think it does. But the reality is, of course, the Fed shouldn't be doing this. They should maintain the rates at the current level, because the economy isn't going to change because of a slight rate cut. It really doesn't have that much effect. What does matter, however, is that if the value of the dollar disappears, then obviously it's more expensive to import the various items that America needs to import, most particularly, of course, oil. Foreigners will tend to take their money out because they're not going to be able to get such high rates if interest rates fall at the same time. And in any case, what's the point of making an investment in dollars if you then lose that investment value in the currency exchange? So this is not a good idea. And most people that I respect would agree with that. So thank you for your question. It is very, very apropos. All right. Let's move on. So Citigroup has now lost its CEO, as I said at the beginning of this hour, and he's been replaced by Robert Rubin. Now, Robert Rubin was Treasury Secretary in the Bill Clinton administration back in 1995, and, of course, he had to deal with the Mexican financial crisis, and not a very auspicious moment in history either, I may say. Unfortunately, poor Robert Rubin is in danger of being seen as being rather out of touch. 2 weeks ago, before this thing blew up, he attempted to reassure a business audience that Citi and other U.S. banks were not imperiled by subprime debt and argued that the economy faced bigger problems. Well, I guess he wishes he'd eaten those words. And he declared, and I quote, "The banks appear to be in fine shape. That's not the problem." Oh, well. So Chuck Prince has gone, as you know. At least this happened since I last spoke to you, so I guess this is news. He resigned on Sunday as chairman and CEO of Citigroup. As the bank said, it may write off $11 billion of subprime mortgage losses on top of the write-down that I mentioned to you last week, last quarter. And so Robert Rubin is now chairman. It falls to me to enunciate, as usual, the severance package of our friend Charles Prince, as he leaves Citigroup in, dare I say the word, shame? Probably not. Why should I? I mean, here he leaves, he's made over $140 million over the last 4 years at the top of Citigroup. And he'll receive another $60 million in stock and retirement benefits as he leaves. You know, it always seems the same way. Risk is rewarded, whether it works or whether it doesn't. If it works, the compensation, you know, is huge stock options. And if it fails, the result is a golden parachute. What a deal, huh? Anyway, Prince's departure came after he told investors on October the 15th, 4 days after an investment banking management shakeup, that the board thought Citigroup had a, and I quote, good, sustainable strategic plan, and that further management changes weren't needed. And now we have what amounts to a parrot replacing him. In a joint interview, Rubin and chief executive named, who is Sir Win Bischoff, expressed support for Prince's overall strategy. And I quote, "The board is extremely supportive of Chuck's strategy," Rubin said. "This is absolutely the right track." Well, ladies and gentlemen, what kind of right track leads to $11 billion of losses in subprime mortgages? What kind of board supports such strategies? Prince has now been replaced, you know, by, by a parrot singing the same tune. Are shareholders going to be happy with the cost of replacing a prince with a parrot? Oh, man. It really gets worse and worse. It is such a scandal. And nobody in the press is writing about this. Of course, they tell you the news, but, I mean, they don't put the right slant on it. You don't get the full picture. It's really, it's absurd, actually, if you think about it. If you really consider that we all have to suffer because of these shenanigans, and that the press just rallies round these bigwigs, you know, as though they were kind of you know, God's personal emissaries of Savior. You know, it's sickening, it truly is. And, you know, since I started with this show and I tried to expose some of this nonsense, you must be getting used to it by now. Whether you get actually numbed to the process, I really can't tell. But it certainly is quite astonishing to me that, you know, the press should ignore it. I mean, but then there are stories, you know, of how people lose their jobs. I mean, if anybody is a maverick in the media, and they stick their head out, they get slammed down again. Anybody in the media, anybody who dares to question this kind of thing, they get, you know, they get basically shut down, muzzled. You know, it's called censorship. It's censorship of the worst order because it's subtle and you don't recognize it. You know, at least in true dictatorships, in stated and declared dictatorships, you know, the government just comes down on you like a ton of bricks. But here it's all done kind of surreptitiously, so you don't really know, you know. Anyway, all right, let me just talk a little bit about why financial executives do actually earn far more than what I would call real economy CEOs. If you look at the highest paid one-half of 1% of Americans, you know, who do you find? Well, according to a study by University of Chicago professors Stephen Kaplan and Joshua Raw, more than twice as many Wall Street financiers as corporate executives. So why do you imagine there's such a huge disparity between executives in the financial economy and those in the real economy? If you believe pay is a measure of someone's economic value, you might think that Wall Street's top brass is just plain smarter. I mean, consider the inventiveness and daring required to create collateralized debt obligations, structured credit derivatives, credit default swaps, and all the other financial innovations over the last few years, some of which, although no one seems to know how much of which, have rested on subprime loans. Well, you might want to think again. Last week, Merrill Lynch stunned investors by announcing a $7.9 billion write-down of bonds backed by subprime mortgages, billions more than the company had forecast earlier this month. Then, earlier this week, Merrill's top gun, Stanley O'Neill, was sacked. But don't cry for him. He'll get a $140 million goodbye gift, far higher than the golden parachutes of most CEOs in the real economy who flame out. Even when it comes to being fired, it seems Wall Street's top brass do better than regular CEOs. Other Wall Street heads may be on the chopping block soon. Despite all the hype about each big bank having its own unique expertise, the fact is they've all used similar techniques for highly leveraged and largely unaccountable speculation, which means their balance sheets are likely to have similar credibility problems. With their fiscal years ending in November and their auditors requiring that assets reflect market realities, expect other big write-downs. Citigroup could be next. In other words, there's no reason to believe Wall Street executives have been smarter than executives in the real non-financial economy. They've been paid more because they've been smarter at creating schemes that have only appeared to create value while keeping investors in the dark. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that is from Robert Reich's blog. Robert Reich is the nation's 22nd Secretary of Labor and a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And that is from his personal journal, his personal blog. Okay. So, what do we have here? Well, Robert Reich obviously thinks that Wall Street CEOs get paid more than their Main Street counterparts because they're liars. You know, it's certainly true. While Wall Street CEOs are generally pretty smart, Main Street CEOs are pretty smart too. Not that pay should really be correlated to intelligence anyway. A lot of very clever people have proven themselves excellent at destroying billions of dollars in value over the years. And the second part, you know, certainly has an element of truth to it as well. The profits for which Stan O'Neill got paid $46 million last year were not the kind of profits any shareholder would, in hindsight, have wanted. But none of this really explains the enormity of Wall Street pay packages. After all, there are many non-financial firms which made just as much money last year as Merrill Lynch, and precious few of them paid their CEOs $46 million. I think that one of the big reasons why Wall Street CEOs make so much money is that they actually make much less money than their non-financial counterparts if their take-home pay is expressed as a multiple of the firm's average salary. On Wall Street, everybody is very highly paid, not just the CEOs. And in most firms, there's a star trader or two who actually makes more money than the CEO in any given year. On Wall Street, the measure of success is the size of your pay package, much more than it is on Main Street, which helps to explain those Brobdingnagian checks at the end of each year. And then, of course, you know, there's the fact that ultimately the bank's revenue has to go somewhere. And if it doesn't go to the employees, it'll go to the shareholders. But shareholders just aren't as important on Wall Street as they are elsewhere. Up until pretty recently, the likes of Goldman Sachs and Lazard Frères and Blackstone were all privately held. There are still pretty large banks like Rothschild, which see no reason to go public and do very well for themselves. And if the banks don't really need their shareholders, those shareholders don't have too much ability to push for a bigger slice of the pie for themselves. So, you know, I'm sure that in retrospect, when push comes to shove, they will talk a lot more about these kind of differentials and the inadequacy of shareholder pressure to put paid to this kind of shenanigans. But all this, of course, comes after the event. This happens when it becomes sort of safe to do it, when it becomes politically expedient to root out the wrongdoing and the fraud and the shenanigans. You know, we all knew during the 1990s what was going on in some of these firms like Adelphia, you know, and even Enron. You know, you had the whistleblower in Enron, this lady who told countless people what was happening, and she was just ignored because the markets were going up, and people said, hey, if markets are going up and things look good, why rock the boat? You know, why upset the store here? But of course, when things went bad, when push came to shove, when the NASDAQ collapsed, then of course people, you know, turned around and, you know, whipped around and looked for their scapegoat. And guess what? They found it. They found their scapegoat. And they found it in Enron. They found it in all kinds of places where, you know, arbitration took place, lawsuits came, helter-skelter. These things happen always after the event. They never happen in order to preempt the event. They always allow the event to take place, and then people whip round looking for their scapegoat. And I am here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that what they will find when they do this, and I'm talking about any avenue of endeavor, not just, as it were, in 1999, the tech sector, but in any endeavor, any branch of finance, you are going to find wrongdoing uncovered, lawsuits flying. It's going to be years. It's probably, I would say, 20 years before this is all sorted out. Very, very sad indeed. All right, let me just talk a little bit about the oil price. Now, you've all seen how oil prices have been soaring in recent weeks. We are almost at $100 a barrel in oil. We are making new highs as I speak, as we talk, as I mention these words. We are ticking up to new highs. We're up to almost $97 a barrel of crude oil. While I was researching this story, I had to laugh. You know, the New Times business section story last Tuesday was by a reporter named Michael Grinbaum, who wrote, and I quote, "Oil is on a steady march towards toppling the inflation-adjusted high of $101.70 it set in April 1980, analysts said, though many are at a loss as to what keeps driving the price." End of quote. Well, actually, lots of people know what's driving up the price. apparently just not the representatives of that clueless newspaper. But anyway, it can be stated quite simply. The demand line has crossed the supply line. So that simple fact has actually many curious ramifications. So let's look at some of the things here. You have an unwieldy global boom stoking unprecedented demand in China, India, Asia generally, and the other emerging markets, including Brazil and Russia. You have energy production constraints and very serious bottlenecks and shortages. So you've got the foreigners stuck holding dollars at a hemorrhaging value, who quite frankly would rather spend them on something other than dollar-denominated financial paper. And nothing is more crucial to the maintenance of industrial economies than oil. Then you have reported oil and gasoline shortages in China, which are bad enough to have already caused some civil unrest, and bad enough for China's leadership to want to spend some of its vast U.S. dollar reserves bidding up oil prices in the open markets to quell that unrest. You know, when you get this hoarding, which is, you know, what caused very much the gas lines of the 1970s here in the States, you get this hoarding behavior. Nothing is actually more complicated than hoarding behavior on a global scale. It amounts to a mounting crisis of frightened self-interest that actually investment banker Matthew Simmons described so well. He was just one of many analysts who spoke at the mid-October Houston conference put on by ASPO USA, which is the Association of the Study for Peak Oil. Needless to say, of course, our famous newspaper, the New York Times, failed to send a reporter to. Simmons, by the way, also said that the American public and its leaders will probably not get the fundamental problem with oil until rising prices are joined by spot shortages, i.e., again, gas station lines, which will represent hoarding behavior on the basis of individual motorists. But behind the hoarding dynamics are several very clear circumstances. One of the big ones is, of course, the growing export crisis, which has been described by geologist Jeffrey Brown. You know, countries like Saudi Arabia and Mexico are selling oil to importing nations like the USA and Japan, using more of their own oil and producing less. Mexico's trajectory is so steep due to the severe depletion of its giant cancer of oil field that it could easily go from being America's number three source of imports to zero in less than 5 years. The anticipated yearly growth in worldwide oil demand next year will equal 80% of the USA's entire oil production. Another big element is the condition of the equipment, which is used all over the world for getting it out of the ground, moving it around the globe and refining it into useful byproducts like gasoline and aviation fuel. The world is woefully short of drilling rigs, and the cost of steel is way up. The demand for new equipment is out of sight. The existing worldwide inventory of equipment can be fairly described as decrepit. As Simmons points out, there is a frightening gap between the need for investment in new rigs, tankers, and refineries, and the money available to just keep production at current levels. The outlook is grim. In fact, the worldwide lack of will to invest in oil industry equipment is itself a symptom of the crack-up of global finance as a complex system under duress. On top of the equipment problem is a human resource problem. The world is not producing enough oil technicians and engineers to keep up with production, let alone increase it. And every year, another wave of senior specialists retires out of the system. And then beyond these parts of the oil price story are even more subplots, like the political strife in Nigeria that effectively holds its oil industry hostage, not to mention the fragile state of affairs throughout the Middle East. And dare we leave out the insane habits of America's happy motoring utopia? There really is no excuse for the New York Times and the rest of the mainstream news media to not understand what is going on out there. The pervasive cluelessness is a symptom of another complex system out of whack, a system that informs us what is going on. Meanwhile, the danger mounts. The heating season is underway and the furnaces are clanking. Many Americans will have to start choosing whether to pay their mortgage, fill the tank of the Chevy Suburban, buy that brick of Velveeta, or pay the heating oil guy. It looks like China will be spending more of its accumulated dollars bidding up the price of oil or making favorable contacts with foreign suppliers instead of buying Freddie Mac bonds. The USA could not find itself in a less favorable position among all these forces roiling the scene. It certainly cannot afford to continue its pathetic pose of cluelessness. Well, as you can see, as each week, one week turns into another, you basically come, I think, to the conclusion very quickly that things now are looking so grim that it's just a matter of time before this whole thing melts down. When it happens, most people will not be aware of what's happening. They'll see these things happening, and they will have no real clear idea of why it is so. And I hope that one day somebody writes a book and explains not just what happened, but the kind of psychology behind what happened. I mean, what caused, you know, these otherwise serious firms, investment company firms, to completely lose their minds, to throw caution to the winds, to basically embark upon a suicide course of business activity that had to lead to trouble in the long run. When you do get to read about this in retrospect, and I like to talk about retrospect from, you know, a future perspective, because like that, when you do come to read back into the past, you, my listeners, will never be able to say that you weren't warned. You will never be able to say that the concept of what happened was not made available to you. So as you then read to people who, you know, like Alan Greenspan, who now goes around, you know, happily being the soothsayer, you know, the man who predicts the future, which he himself created through his absurd, irresponsible policies. When you come back and you read, you know, people who are now telling you how bad everything is and how bad it was and why it happened, always after the event, you will be able to smile and say, yes, but I knew all that in advance. So if I knew it all in advance, then why couldn't these people have known it in advance? And why couldn't they have done something about it? So, of course, if they could have done something about it, the question then becomes, why did they do what they did? Why did they allow these things to happen? What kind of evil processes went on in their minds to conjure up these frightful financial shenanigans? And quite frankly, there won't be an answer, ladies and gentlemen. You won't get that answer. That will be your job. It will be your job to assess why these things happened, fully in the knowledge that you knew they were happening even before they happened. And it will be fascinating, because very few people will be in that situation with a window to the future, looking back at the future, at the past in the future. It will be a fascinating phenomenon. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I must leave you. We've come to the end of our time. This is Richard Martin, Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, bidding you a very happy, successful week, and I'll be with you again on Friday. So take care, and bye-bye for now.